Here. Thank you, Debbie. Welcome, everyone. We're going to open the Senate Committee on Workforce. Today is Monday, May 15th, and we are going to have three public hearings today. We're going to go out of order from the agenda. First, we're going to hear House Bill 2567A, because we have Representative Witt here, and then we'll hear House Bill 3060A, and then last, we'll hear House Bill 2162A. So, Representative Witt, why don't you come up? We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2567A. Deborah will summarize the bill, please.
HB 2567A was sponsored by Representative Witt, requires employers with 100 or more employees to provide 60 days notice to employees and government officials before ceasing or relocating operations or laying off 50 or more employees. Creates exceptions to notice requirement, requires employer to provide documentation to court or Bureau of Labor and Industries when invoking exception involving active pursuit of capital or business, provides private right of action and holds employer liable for back pay and benefits. A fiscal impact was issued, there's no revenue impact, and the House vote was 33-23.
Okay, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, State Representative Brad Witt, House District 31, and with me today is Megan Baumhart, who is an intern in my office and has done a considerable amount of background research on this bill. So I get the easy questions and the hard ones are directed to her. So
we'll work on that.
All right. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2567A creates a little WARN Act, Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification Act, patterned after the federal act of 1989. The bill requires, just like the federal act, employers with 100 or more employees at any single commercial or industrial facility to give 60 days advance notice to their workforce, as well as state and local government, before ceasing operations, relocating their business, or laying off 50 or more employees. Now, the bill also provides for exceptions to the 60-day advance notice in the following circumstances: a natural disaster, a catastrophe, where the employer is actively seeking additional business or capital at the time of the layoff, a limited duration project, and or seasonal or temporary work. Just like the federal law, House Bill 2567A enables employees to recover back pay and benefits costs for any period of time up to the maximum of the 60-day notice requirement, so up to 60 days for any days among those 60 days that the notice was not given in advance. And lastly, and again, similar to the federal act, House Bill 2567A provides for reasonable attorney fees for the prevailing plaintiff as when he or she is seeking back pay or benefits. The bill is an attempt to limit to the greatest extent possible economic dislocation from plant closures and mass layoffs. The notion is the early intervention before the layoff occurs has the best results, the fastest results, the most cost-effective results, and the most efficacious results in terms of getting people back to work and ameliorating the broad and general adverse impacts of dislocation. It's important that this notice go to the parties involved, both the workforce as well as state and local government, so that providers of services then are prepared to begin delivering the services to the workers who will be losing their jobs, and of course for the workers themselves, because it is always best to get a job while you still have one. And I would just add that in the interest of trying to minimize the economic and fiscal fallout of mass layoffs, this is an exceedingly important bill, important for the workers, important for their families, important for communities, and important for the providers of services. I would strongly urge your positive action on House Bill 2567A. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Knope.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative. For those of us who aren't familiar with the federal act, I mean, I generally know what it is, but can you tell me the key differences between the bill that you're proposing versus the federal act itself?
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Knope, I think the singular and major difference between this proposed piece of legislation and the federal act is the fact that the federal act is permissive on attorney's fees, and this bill mandates attorney fees for a prevailing plaintiff. So I think that is the really significant difference between the two.
Okay. Follow up?
Yes, sir.
I noticed that this talks about relocating. Does the federal law also apply to relocation, or is the federal law just for, like, ceasing operations and just general massive layoffs?
Madam Chair, Senator Knope, it includes relocation as well.
So can you tell, where did this bill come from? How did this come to be?
Madam Chair, a very good question. If this virtually mirrors the federal act, why do we need a little state act?
Yeah.
Important point. Thank you for the question. There have been some adverse federal court decisions recently over the past, I don't know, year and a half, something close to that, where we've kind of discovered a loophole, if you will, with regard to the advance notice. The issue being that under the federal act, you have to be an active, quote-unquote, active employee in order to be entitled to receive the notice. The courts have ruled that in the instances of a bankruptcy, you are considered laid off at the point that bankruptcy is declared and therefore no longer an active employee. And so we're finding that as beneficial as advance notice is, it's not having to be given in many instances, again, specifically bankruptcy. And the intent of this little act is to help overcome that what I refer to as a loophole.
And so is there a specific factory? Is there somewhere where this has occurred here in Oregon? I mean, is there?
Madam Chair, to the best of my knowledge, I'm not aware of any of any occurrences here in the state of Oregon where that has occurred. But again, because there have been several federal courts who have ruled that, I mean, the probability is high that it could be ruled same way here for the state of Oregon in this federal court jurisdiction.
Okay. All right. Does anybody have any yet? Senator Hansel.
Representative, if, for example, I know right now a lot of the retail companies are having a real rough go, and let's say Penny's closed down 8 locations in Oregon, they would perhaps have the number of people here, but each store is kind of separate. I mean, would they be involved in something like that if they were a part of a larger or a bank that closed a bunch of branches? I mean, you know, rather than just one location that laid people off.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Hansel, I think The answer is 99% of the cases. I think the answer would be yes if it is a full-blown retail outlet. Again, it's 100 or more employees per site. So I think that perhaps the facility here in Salem would definitely qualify. There may be the individual cases where you have a catalog sales outlet that would come nowhere as close to being 100 employees. So just depends on the individual case and the trigger mechanism, again, being that 100 employees.
Follow up. Well, what I was, let's say if Pendleton has 50 and LeGrand has 50. I don't even know if LeGrand has a Penny's. They close, the total is 100. If it's per site, then neither one of them would fall under this. That's what I'm hearing you say.
Let's see. Madam Chair, Senator Hansel, that is the way the bill is written, correct? So it would not trigger unless there were 100 employees at a single site, or if there were contiguous sites. So if we had the same, let's say we had the same manufacturer who had like a campus style arrangement, and there were several buildings on a campus doing the same product, then it would trigger. If it's a campus doing different products, and even though it's the same employer, it likely would not trigger. So,
and then for the back pay, the federal act requires that the back pay be paid. That's already in federal law.
Yes, correct.
All right. So, Senator Monson,
it has been known, or it's that employees sometimes are given a 24 hours notice when their employment is going to be terminated, primarily for the fact that piracy happens with software, and it happens, and I was just wondering, what is the protection for the businesses if 60 days is given and there are maybe unscrupulous employees that will try to
sabotage? Madam Chair, Senator Mota Sanderson, I think again, this is an issue of someone who's being laid off as opposed to someone who's being fired for just cause. Certainly sabotaging one's employer, I don't think there's anyone that would stand or would even attempt to justify that. That's a terminable offense, I think, on the spot, and it's not something that I'm aware of that has become any kind of overwhelming problem under the federal act. Is currently the situation that employers are operating under right now in this state, and I don't see that changing. And again, if someone's out there trying to sabotage the employer's business, they should be out the door immediately, instantaneously.
The follow-up. Well, I'm primarily thinking, and these are for companies with 100 and more employees. Is that correct? Okay. I'm thinking more of the IT business where, a lot of information is privy to the employees, and if that business goes away, then the employees would have time to be able to, steal the software.
Okay, Chair and Senator, I think, and correct me if you know differently, but I think most high-tech companies are quite sophisticated in terms of their ability to protect their intellectual property. I think many of them have contracts that the employees sign when they come to work that they will not be divulging or otherwise inappropriately using information that they gather while they're on the job. I think most of these employers have established policies that protect themselves against that, and it's again no different, I think, than what's currently in existence in the state. And I'm not aware of it. It's not to say that cases haven't arisen where someone has gone out and divulged employer information, but again, I think that subjects them to termination and possibly some lawsuits, depending on what kind of employment contract they may have signed when they came to work.
Thank you.
Okay. And so the change that from Senator Knope's question about the major change being between the Federal Act and this, about the legal fees, what does it say in the Federal Act now about how the legal fees are paid for?
It's permissive.
Okay.
So.
All right. So that's just the judge decides who pays?
I'm sorry.
So the judge decides who pays?
The judge decides whether or not the plaintiff, correct?
Yes.
Whether or not the plaintiff can pursue attorney's fees.
Okay. All right. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, Senator Hansel.
Representative, could you just summarize what is the problem we're trying to fix with 2567A that the Federal Act does not already cover?
Certainly. Chair and Senator, as it stands currently, the federal reporting requirement is relieved in many instances, depending upon the court jurisdiction, because there have been several court rulings, that requirement to report 60 days in advance is relieved in the instances of bankruptcy. And whether or not you lose your job due to bankruptcy or whatever the issue is, it's still very, very important to be able to deliver dislocated worker services before the place closes down. That's when the best results are achieved, while everyone is still at work. So that bankruptcy judges have ruled that at the point bankruptcy is declared, that workforce is no longer, quote unquote, an active employees. And so, as I say, the notice is relieved. This bill attempts to then continue in place the requirement for 60 days advance notice.
Follow.
Yes, Senator Hansel.
So if there would be no relief to a company under the proposed law, if they declare bankruptcy, they would still have 60 days of expenses, or they would declare bankruptcy, but it really wouldn't take effect for another 60 days based upon what their responsibility to the workforce would be.
Chair and Senator, it would be the employer's decision. If the 60 days notice is not given, that establishment would be on the hook for paying wages and benefits costs for those 60 days.
So it would be sort of, we're going to declare bankruptcy in 60 days, would be the kind of a notice that the company would be required to give. If that was what was going to have to happen.
Madam Chair, Senator Hansel, no. That is not the case.
Okay.
Just like the current act does not require you to in any way stay moving the business, you can decide to do that without giving the notice. But you're still, the notion is that that workforce is going to have 60 days of income in which they're going to be able to make plans, get retraining, et cetera, so that when, in fact, they're no longer an employee, when they're actually laid off, that hopefully they're well on the road to transitioning into a new job.
Paul, I'm just trying to really get my arms around this. You said the only difference was bankruptcy. So the others, if they're moving or laying off or something like that, I can understand that. That's covered on the federal act, I believe. But on the area, if I'm a company and I've reached a point where I've got to declare bankruptcy, what will be different by way of what I would be required to do under the state law than what I'm currently required to do under the federal law, if that's the only difference we're talking about?
Madam Chair, Senator Hansel, nothing.
Well, then what's the difference between the two?
Because the difference is if you declare a bankruptcy in some of the federal court jurisdictions, you no longer have to report because you don't meet the definition of an active employee.
Okay.
All right. This bill is an attempt under state law to say that you would still be covered in the instance of bankruptcy, and that employer would be obligated to give the workforce 60 days advance notice.
Okay, well, that was part of my question, then. I would need to declare that in 60 days I'm going to do bankruptcy.
Maybe it would be helpful for Deborah. Deborah's been doing some looking. Can you maybe paraphrase what's...
So I would say under the state law, they would still have to give the notice within the 60 days notice, whereas under the federal law, in some jurisdictions where the federal courts have ruled that, or in jurisdictions where the federal courts haven't ruled and may rule, they may be relieved of that burden.
Okay.
So the difference in state law would be that they would definitely not be relieved. They must give that 60-day notice still.
Okay. That's helpful. Good.
Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate your help.
All right. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
And I hope that Representative Witt is treating you well. Okay. So let's go ahead and bring up Betsy Earls, please. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and Oregon Business Association. And I'm appearing before you today in a posture of current opposition to 2567. Although I will tell you that we have worked with Representative Witt on the House side, and I think that there are still some problems with 2567 to work through, but I think that we can probably work them out on this side if he is willing and the committee is interested in doing that. I don't know if it is of great value for me to go through all of the changes that we would need, but I think there are several areas of the bill that maybe are not huge differences between the Federal WARN Act and what is in 2567 that would end up being important to employers if they weren't altered before the bill passed. So one example is in Section 2, the bill requires the employer to notify not only the affected employee, but also a series of administrative agencies. And our position is that that is unnecessarily burdensome because there is already a state response in place in situations where the WARN Act is triggered. When the employer notifies the dislocated worker unit, that swings into action all of the services that the Employment Department and the WorkSource Oregon and the Workforce Investment Boards would already be bringing into play. So we would like to change some of those smaller details of the bill that I think would make it easier for employers to comply with.
Okay. Is there anything else that you want to bring to our attention?
I can go through. One of the other things that we are concerned about is Section 3 provides for employee recovery under the new state law, but it doesn't exempt workers who accept jobs at different job sites of the employer within 6 months, and WARN exempts those employees. Section 4 exempts employers who are actively seeking new capital from the notification requirement. And WARN applies this exemption to mass layoffs, but 2567 at this point does not apply that exemption to mass layoffs. And that's something that we talked about on the House side and didn't make it into the amendment. So I think we can probably work through that on this side.
Okay.
For example, and there's also a concern about if you're providing papers to prove that you're seeking capital as an employer to Boley or whoever, you would, under WARN Act, you would get an assurance of confidentiality of those papers that 2567 doesn't provide. So we would want to put something together related to that piece.
Okay. Anybody have any questions from Ms. Earls? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And then we have Paloma Sparks here from Boley. Hello.
Good afternoon. For the record, Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I just wanted to mention a couple things. Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Canope, members of the committee. House Bill 2567, we would likely do some rules to try and align it with the Wage Security Fund, which is how particularly if a business has filed bankruptcy or has gone out of business, how employees can claim to get their last paycheck paid out of the Wage Security Fund. We also have some concerns about the language regarding how claims would be joined. So how if we had multiple employees file complaints and for expedience purposes joined all of those claims, there's a bit of a penalty in there if we joined all those claims together, which I would imagine for the employer is actually better for us to join the claims, but the way it's written, that would make that financially untenable for us.
Okay. Any questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So we are going to thank you, everyone, for coming to talk about this, something we can all think about. So we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 2567A. And then let's go ahead and we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3060A. Deborah, if you could summarize, please.
HB 3060A, chief sponsors include Representatives Leiniger, Noss, Sanchez, Alonso Leon, and Power. It requires certain state contracts to include as a material term that the contractor certifies that the contractor has a policy in practice to prevent sexual harassment, sexual assault, and discrimination against members of protected classes. Prohibits state contracting agency from entering into a public contract with an anticipated price exceeding $150,000 with a contractor that is not certified in writing that a contractor has such a policy and practice. Specifies minimum requirements of policy and practice. Allows Department of Administrative Services to develop policy template and provide other guidance for contractors in meeting requirements. Becomes operative January 1st, 2018. Takes effect 91st day following adjournment of sine die. Has a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and a House vote of 53-5.
Welcome, Representative Leiniger.
Thank you, Chair
Taylor.
So
nice to see you.
You too. Thank you, Chair Taylor and members of the committee. I'm Ann Leiniger, State Representative for Lake Oswego and Southwest Portland, and I'm pleased to be here today to present to you a bill, the goal of which is to prevent workplace sexual harassment, sexual assault, and other discrimination before it happens. In order to prevent both the workers and the businesses from having to deal with the difficult situations that arise after discrimination has happened. So we have all seen on the news that there have been some high-profile incidents of workplace sexual harassment, sexual assault in recent months. You may be aware that a national jewelry chain, which has offices in Oregon, has been subject to, I believe it's a class action claim, by a group of women employees who articulate that there's been some systematic sexual harassment at the company. Folks who have watched the broadcast news arena have seen high-profile incidents. I think Gretchen Carlson of Fox News reported having been subject to some pretty troubling conduct. There have been incidents in which African-American members of the Oregon workforce have at work been subject to threats and harassment. And the bottom line is, once harassment, sexual harassment, or other kinds of workplace harassment has happened, the worker is really in a lose-lose situation. And it's bad for the business, too, but it's really bad for the worker, because take sexual harassment, sexual assault, you know, your options once it happens are you can go along with it, even if you don't think it's where you want to be. You can directly tell the person who's instigating it to stop and risk retaliation in some form, be it getting a worse schedule or getting a bad review or possibly even losing your job. Or you can go into a legal proceeding, which creates a lot of tension in a workplace, as we all discussed with another bill last week. You know, once the conduct has happened, it's a real lose-lose situation for the worker, and I'd say also for the business. So what this bill seeks to do is strengthen prevention efforts, and to do it using the state's power of the purse. The idea is, and I used to work as a in-house attorney and an attorney for employers. And I was amazed by how many employers don't have clear anti-discrimination, anti-harassment policies that they distribute to workers. So the concept of this legislation is that if you want to do business with the state of Oregon, and I think we'd all agree that the state really believes that workers should be treated fairly and not subject to harassment or discrimination based on protected class features. If you want to do business with the state of Oregon, you have to certify. If you want to get a contract with the state at a value of over $150,000, you have to certify to be eligible to enter into that contract that your business has clear written policies given to workers that articulate that the business will not tolerate workplace harassment or discrimination based on a protected class, that indicate if you experience or witness that kind of harassment or discrimination, who you can contact at the workplace to report it to make it stop. Just like we in the legislature have some designated, you know, people to hear complaints. And to also that the you must certify that your policy has a written provision that promises you won't be retaliated against for reporting having witnessed or experienced harassment or discrimination. We have worked closely with Department of Administrative Services and also AOI and AGC and other advocates, and succeeded in agreeing that it would be useful to have a template of notice that you could post in your business to make those things clear, or that you could distribute to your employees. And the idea is that this bill would send a very strong management level message that, hey, that kind of conduct doesn't fly here, don't do it. And in so doing, it would help prevent people from being in the really terrible situation of having to decide what to do next when they face harassment or discrimination. It's a pretty simple bill. I am not aware of any organized opposition. We really are grateful for the teamwork of folks from both the business community and the worker advocacy community on the bill, and hopefully it will earn your support. And I believe that Bill Nestle and possibly also Aaron Knott from DOJ are here to answer technical questions.
Okay, you're right, they are here.
Yes.
But well, thank you. Does anybody have any questions? I think it sounds great. I think that's a really good idea. Thank you for bringing it forward. Why don't we go ahead and bring up Barbara Ross, Stacey Cowan, and Kim Olson, please. And then Aaron and Bill, did you want to testify? You're just here for support if needed. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Barbara Ross, and I'm here representing the League of Women Voters, and we have submitted written testimony. But I just want to say that I think that this is an important step forward, because in terms of women getting into the workplace and having jobs that create money for them and their families, I think that the whole construction industry is a place where women are showing that they can work effectively and that they can be there. But we do know that there is tension when they are in those construction jobs, and that they're not uniformly accepted. And so I think it's really important that when the state is contracting to get something done, to get a big highway project, a bridge, or whatever we're doing, that those women who go into those positions are protected. And I think this bill is a big step forward in terms of getting the policies in place. And I fully support the idea that this is a prevention bill. It is helping us to get ahead of the curve and not just cry after a tragedy's happened or an unfortunate incident's happened. So on the behalf of the League of Women Voters, I hope you will support it.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, my name is Kim Olson, and I'm here in my capacity as Vice Chair of the Oregon Commission for Women. This is actually the first time I've been able to see Senator Montezanas and only hear her over the phone during our meetings. The commission stands strongly in support of this bill. As we've heard from the previous testimony, this is a preemptive step. It's extremely important. Organizations, businesses, nonprofits should be adopting clear policies on sexual harassment, sexual assault, discrimination in order to do business with the state. And the state should be providing leadership and expecting accountability in this area. And we should be clearly stating that we don't tolerate harassment and we are going to hold organizations accountable on these issues. If the leaders and captains of Oregon's industries take this small step before they do business with the state, it will have a dramatic effect on our state's culture. Workplace harassment is a persistent problem, and it's incumbent upon all of us to be a part of the fight to stop the harassment. The impact of this new law in Oregon could spur a new wave of marginalized minorities joining industries that have shut them out or help them to grow the number of women in traditionally male fields. This bill is a measure of our state's leadership in its anti-harassment efforts. It's a proactive policy and one small step to ensure that all of Oregon's communities prosper equitably. So again, the commission is in steadfast opposition of forms of sexual and gender discrimination, and we urge the adoption of this bill.
Okay, great. Ms. Cowan.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, Stacey Cowan with SEIU Local 503. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3060. I'm actually here on behalf of both SEIU Local 49 and Local 503 and the nearly 65,000 workers that we represent. SEIU has a long history of working to improve the contracting process through transparency, accountability, and setting a high standard for contractors receiving public dollars. So this is a really important topic for us. SEIU represents both contracted employees by the state and state employees. In 2009, we supported legislation to require public contracting agencies to compare the anticipated cost to contract out with the cost to perform the work in-house on procurement for services worth more than $250,000. The purpose of the legislation was to provide a system to ensure that we're being as efficient with taxpayer dollars as possible. We strongly believe that we really should be scrutinizing how every tax dollar is spent and making sure that companies the state contracts with are transparent and have those same high standards for employee safety. This is critical to being good stewards of the public dollar, and we believe that House Bill 3060 is a good step in that direction that protects worker safety on the job. Additionally, sexual harassment, sexual assault, and discrimination are significant problems in Oregon workplaces. Women in Oregon face the second highest frequency of rape and sexual assault in the United States, according to the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. The Federal Bureau of Justice Statistics have found that 8% of rapes in the U.S. occur while the victim is working. Some studies have estimated that anywhere between 5,000 and 17,000 sexual assaults in the U.S. in U.S. workplaces happen each year. So this is a huge problem that often remains hidden. Too often victims of workplace sexual violence feel that their employer is not prepared to hold perpetrators accountable. As a result, more than 60% of workplace rapes and sexual assault cases go unreported, according to an estimate by the Bureau of Justice Statistics. That's the lowest reporting rate among all violent crimes in the workplace. So how to reduce the risk of sexual assault, harassment, and discrimination, we feel, is not rocket science. The solution absolutely begins with employers maintaining policies and practices to ensure employees and managers are trained, that complaints are thoroughly investigated, and that perpetrators are held accountable. Public contracting should be a model of best practice in human resource, and House Bill 3060 is a clear best practice standard in preventing workplace harassment and sexual assault. When contractors are paid with public dollars, they should be held to a standard that protects the public's interest in safety and fairness, and I absolutely urge your support for House Bill 3060.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thank you for coming. All right. So we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3060A, and let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2162A. And Deborah, she is going to summarize the bill, and we have the Dash 5 amendment. And so folks should pay attention to the amendment as well. And committee members, we're going to be talking about the bill, the amendment, in a little more detail here today. So why don't you go ahead and tell us what it's all about, please.
Okay. H. Bill 2162A was introduced at the request of the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor. It requires state contracting agency to require contractor on public improvement contracts above $5 million to employ apprentices to perform 10% of work hours that workers in apprenticeable occupations perform. In 2022, it increases the employment requirement to 12% and the contract price threshold to $3 million. Exempts Department of Transportation and emergency procurements. Requires the Bureau of Labor and Industries to establish and provide staffing for an advisory committee that monitors implementation and compliance. Becomes operative January 1st, 2018. Takes effect 91st day following adjournment sine die. It has a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and a House vote of 53-3. The Dash 5 amendment replaces the measure. It requires public contract bidders for contracts of $5 million or more after January 1, 2019 to demonstrate responsibility by employing apprentices for 10% or more of the hours employees worked during the previous calendar year, or by belonging to a local joint committee whose training agents employed apprentices for 10% or more of hours that training agent employees worked on contracts in the previous calendar year. It grants the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries discretion in setting a percentage at which a public agency may determine a public contract bidder responsibility. It requires a contracting agency to base responsibility determination on a bidder's status as an approved training agent or on local joint committee training agents. It requires contractors and subcontractors to submit compliance statements and appropriates money to the Bureau to enforce compliance. It requires local joint training committee to report to the Bureau the hours worked by apprentices and journey workers, and requires the Bureau to publish hours on its website. The measure declares an emergency and is effective on passage. It was previously proposed in 2015 regular legislative session as SB 809A.
Okay.
Question.
Thank you. Senator Hanselman.
Just want for clarification. It passed out of the House with 53-3 vote. And now we're considering Dash 5 that completely replaces that? Is that what I heard?
It's correct.
That is correct.
Interesting. Okay.
And Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I may, I believe the Dash 5 is the same as the Dash 1, only updated for the engrossed version of the bill, which was amended with the Dash 4.
Now I am really confused. What?
Dash 5, yeah, are those ones that were on the House side? Yeah, so the only one we have on the Senate side is
right.
The Dash 5.
Okay, so why don't you, Deborah, for clarification, why don't you, there's been a lot of discussion about amendments, et cetera. I'm just going to have Deborah explain to us all, so we all are on the same page of what was on the House side, the amendments.
So my understanding is the only amendment on the Senate side is the Dash 5, but there were several amendments proposed when it went on the House side. And this was one of the proposed amendments on the House side that did not make it through.
Okay. So all on when it was worked on the House side, there were different amendments proposed, including this one, and were not accepted and passed out of the House as is with 53. Now we're looking to do an amendment on this side that failed on the House side.
But I think this might be slightly different from the one.
But the House bill was amended.
The House bill was amended with a different amendment.
Right. So which amendment did they accept on the House side?
Oh, I don't know which.
They accepted the Dash 4 amendment.
Dash 4.
Okay.
Dash four.
So the dash four, maybe while we're talking, Deborah can look into that a little bit, but okay. They accepted the, sounds like the dash four, and and so now what we'll do is, I think while Deborah's looking into that a little bit, if that's okay with you, Senator Hansel,
can she look into that
a little bit, and then we'll have some folks come up and testify. Absolutely. So let's have Ron. Yeah, it was the dash four that was accepted. So we'll have Ron Robbins, Jack Dempsey, and Tom Girding. They are all supporting the bill. They're going to come forward and talk to us a little bit. And who's going to start? Mr. Dempsey, why don't we start? Oh,
I'm going to have Ron start. I'll finish up and clarify.
Hi, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm Ron Robbins. I work for the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. I'm also the chair of the statewide JATC Committee 1057. The Carpenters operate the largest apprenticeship program in the state, construction-only apprenticeship program. We have over 1,200 apprentices in the program currently. It's been a great time of growth for us, and we're there's still plenty of room in the industry, and we feel strongly that the state can play a role in creating opportunity in public contracting for young people coming out of schools. Apprenticeship utilization isn't anything new. Most of the states surrounding us have some requirement and have for many years, and Oregon, unfortunately, has lagged in that area. We tend to be pretty progressive on things, but this one area where I think we've kind of been wrestling over the details of what to do and kind of missing the whole point of getting something done. I was involved in the last process. Matter of fact, I sat on the apprenticeship task force. It was a broad-based group with contractors and unions and apprenticeship programs, and we crunched the numbers, and we all took our best shot at, you know, what would the approach look like if we were going to implement our whistles and bells and all of our dreams in an apprenticeship bill. And at the end of it, unfortunately, we couldn't get a broad consensus to come out of the committee, and so we got a bill that sounds very much like what you've described here with the amendments. Now, just to be clear, I support Bill 2162A. Matter of fact, we help author the bill, and as you can see, the basic bill itself is very simple, very straightforward. It's a 10% requirement on projects over $5 million, and really not a whole lot else. And some of the criticism you'll hear today, I'm sure, about the bill is that it's too simple of an approach, that it doesn't there's really no teeth, and it doesn't there's no great deal of reporting or regulation built around it. It's really just kind of simple. And but we understand both through our experience in 2015, but also in operating the largest apprenticeship program in the state, that we find working with our industry partners, our contract partners, on areas of common agreement, that we can get an awful lot done. And so we don't see the necessity, frankly, to have a lot of hoops. One of the approaches is the apprenticeship standards, and the carpenters operate. We hold state-approved standards in carpentry, exterior, interior, that's drywall specialties. We run a millwrights program, pile drivers, bridge and highway carpenters, scaffold erectors, and now divers as well. And so you can see we've got a lot of programs running under one roof. Interestingly, most large municipalities, even in Oregon, I know that Portland has a strong requirement for apprenticeship hours, and their utilization number is 20%. If you're doing business with Multnomah County or Metro or who else is on that list, Portland Parks, You're going to be utilizing apprentices. It's required on their project, and almost uniformly, it's at the 20% level. But we felt like that a good starting place would be 10%. We know that when Washington State implemented their law some years ago, that it took an incremental step towards that implementation of the law. They currently have a 15% requirement on all public contracting, not just state projects like this would do. And so I guess our concept, having been working on this issue for many years and had many attempts at getting a bill on the books in Oregon, we thought the best approach would be to start with something simple, get something on the books that we could build on, and we think that's what 2162A does.
Okay. All right.
Chair Taylor and members of the committee, Jack Dempsey on behalf of the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. Let me walk through exactly what the bill does and then give you a little history on how we got here. So House Bill 2162A, as Rod was pointing out, it establishes a 10% apprenticeship standard. As he mentioned, in Washington it's 15%, in California it's 20%. So it's a low standard. It's just on state projects. The amendment you're going to hear and I'll talk about in the history is on all public projects. This is just state projects. It's on just state projects over $5 million in contract price. So of the thousands of contracts we did in 2015, which is the last data set I had, that was five projects. So not very many. In 4 years, it changes. We raise the standard up to 12%, and we lower the threshold down to state contract prices over $3 million, which in 2015 would pick up another six contracts. So it's a very incremental approach on this. It also establishes an advisory committee within the apprenticeship division that's half labor and half management, not regulatory, advisory. Their job it will be to look at this, figure out what's working, what's not working. From our standpoint, hopefully they're going to show that this works great and we need to come back and expand this into other areas. That's the bill. A brief history on this. When we started working on this in the 2013 session, there was Senate Bill 782, which looked very similar to what ODOT runs now. It had one fatal flaw. It did pass the Senate unanimously and went over the House. The fatal flaw was that it requires the agencies to pay per head for apprentices on top of the contract price. The House didn't like that approach, so what they did is gotten stuff it into an interim task force. Between 13 and 15, the interim task force met. As Ron said, they did not agree on a proposal unanimously. As such, we then went into a smaller room and negotiated out Senate Bill 809, which came during the 15th session. That approach put the concept into a responsible bidder model, and I think most of you know what that is, but it requires more things for contractors to do in order to become a responsible bidder, so it inherently lowers the number of contractors that can apply for these. we supported that concept. It came out of this committee on a partisan line vote, went down to Ways and Means, and was not passed because the votes didn't exist in the Senate. That's the dash A5 amendment that you're considering today. So from the carpenter standpoint, we continue to believe that we need the standard on state projects. So we, prior to the session, decided where do we go from here? So we came in with the most stripped down, bare bones, baby step forward of an approach that we thought we could take on this. Low standard, limited number of projects, just state projects. And that's what this bill represents. It came over from the House unanimously out of the Business and Labor Committee. It passed 53-3. This phased-in approach is what the other states that have done this have implemented. They start off with state projects. They slowly graduate into school districts, local governments, et cetera. What the dash A5 amendment does is take all public projects at once. I would argue that I don't think this committee has felt the full wrath of the local government lobby and the school districts and everyone else that's going to oppose those amendments because they did last session, and that's what killed this concept. There's also a fiscal element to it in that there's a big enforcement mechanism that goes in BOLI. So the bill would have to go down to Ways and Means, and like I said, that's where it ended up dying last session. So I would encourage you to look at this. I would encourage you to consider this a small incremental change towards getting more apprentices on the job in Oregon, which is the bottom line from our standpoint, what we're trying to achieve. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tom Girding. I own a general contracting and specialty firm down in Corvallis. And in addition, I'm also on the board of directors for AGC of Oregon and was a past president actually in 2013. For the past 10 years, I've lived pretty deeply in the apprenticeship in here in Salem and echo a lot of the things that my colleagues to my left have discussed. So briefly on AGC, you know, we're a big tent for the commercial industry, and so we capture union companies, open shop companies, very large contractors all the way to very small contractors, general contractors as well as specialty subcontractors, and metro as well as very rural Oregon. House Bill 2162 has been vetted by our members, and it is a bill that we can certainly support. And one of the key elements for us that's been discussed is the slow phase-in. And because of the variety of firms we represent all over the state, apprenticeship is not as readily available across the state as it is in the Willamette Valley and metro areas. And that's just one piece that's important to us to make sure as it phases in slow that it doesn't create an unlevel playing field. One point I would really like to emphasize is there's nobody that cares more about apprenticeship than us that employ the apprentices, because they're our future. We can everything administratively put a project together, but those out in the field doing the work, they're the ones that are building the projects, and that's our future. So we are very much engaged and care very deeply about apprenticeship and about it being done correctly. Along with that given piece, I'll just make another plug. CTE is so critical to us because that's the pre-apprenticeship. That's who's going to fill the pipeline. And we're excited about the steps that are being made in that direction. And that really, from an apprenticeship standpoint, we need this more now than ever. And so as this has been written, the 2162, we very much support it. I guess other than that, I'm most importantly here to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions?
Just a real quick question.
Yes, Senator Montes.
Why don't employers just do this automatically, having apprenticed?
Can I? I'll answer first since I'm part. We do. Nobody cares more about that than us. However, I am a union contractor, and so maybe that can come off and sound easier because I'm relying upon the gentleman to my left, Ron, making that happen. But we're very much out there promoting the trades. That's why CTE is, quite frankly, so critical to get people coming out of high school with the mindset. One of the pieces that's of interest is I'm not sure this data has been run, but a couple years ago, the average apprentice entering is like 27 years old. And quite frankly, some of our project superintendents who make a very handsome sum of money are past graduates of four-year degrees that went out and then ultimately saw what the trades offer. So I'm rambling a little bit, but we're constantly out there promoting and pushing people towards the apprenticeship.
Yeah, Senator Moynihan Anderson, private contractors and union and non-union programs exist throughout the state. Northwest College of Construction is one that you may be familiar with, but there are non-union programs out there and they're flourishing. One of the things about putting a requirement or some incentive, I guess, to begin one is that contractors sometimes are slow to reinvest in the industry. And we're going through a time of worker shortages now where we've lost a lot of folks out of the industry during the downturn, and we're trying to rebuild. Our own apprenticeship numbers were slashed nearly in half, and so we're trying to rebuild that. In order to get back to fill the need of the industry, we're back in schools. We're doing CTE programs. We have a Career Connections curriculum that's a construction-related curriculum that schools, we've got 18 schools now using it in the classroom because they see the value in connecting schools back to the industry and creating actual vocational training. But we even see private owners and developers now recognizing those worker shortages, and as you know, we all hear a lot about demographics in the country, and so to get out in front of this problem, even private developers and owners now are requiring apprenticeship utilization on their projects.
Any other questions? I just had a couple technical questions. So I wanted to understand more about what are, can you put in perspective the number of apprentice, how many people will actually be able to become an apprentice if we pass this? I mean, what kind of numbers are we talking about potentially? Especially with the transportation package coming, hopefully.
Yeah, well, we I guess it depends on your apprenticeship standards, what the ratios are. But most are and maybe I'm getting too deep a dive. All apprenticeship programs have a state standard that's regulated by the state and tells you how many apprentices you can have on a job site per the size of the crew that's out there. I mean, we've got a lot of room to grow. And our program has ramped up. Carpenter's program is on track to graduate. We graduated 160 just this last Saturday. And it's a four-year program. We've got 1,200 people in it. We can graduate about 300 a year as journeymen and women. And it's not enough. We need to get more kids involved in the program and ramp up with the industry while the jobs are there.
Okay. Now, did somebody know? I'm just trying to get a sense. Is this going to bring on 20 apprentices, 100 apprentices? Like, how many for? Because I think there's how many jobs are there? I mean, how many projects are there? I think you had mentioned before, Mr. Dempsey, in my office, that maybe there was like five projects or so.
Right. Chair Taylor, Jack Dempsey again. I don't think we have a good number, but yes, it's less than 10 projects we're talking about.
Okay.
So it is initially, I would say, a small number of apprentices. I'm not sure I can quantify.
Is that under 50, do you think? Or?
I do just want to clarify one point you made. So Department of Transportation is exempt from this process.
Oh, that's right.
They currently have their own apprenticeship standard in place, and this just catches the construction piece up with the rest of the road.
I apologize. You did tell me that previously, and that was my fault for forgetting that. But is it under 50 apprentices? Or 25? I'm just trying to – I don't have any sense of what scale
really
this is.
Really depends on the size of the project, but on a project with 100 workers, we'd have 10 apprentices under this bill.
Yeah, okay. And then I'm trying to understand – for the carpenters, when you're on a job site, who are you usually reporting to?
So we supply labor to general contractors. Many more now than in the past are self-performing and self-performing more scopes. So we also supply labor to pile driving contractors who work on soil stabilization and foundation work.
Uh-huh.
We pour the heavy concrete, so that's part of the carpenter's craft. We'll be on site with the subcontractor that does steel stud framing. In commercial work is most common because of the fire ratings and that in high-rise and commercial-type development.
Mm-hmm.
Steel stud framing and drywall is covered under our EIS programs. So we potentially... outside of the utilities, there's also iron workers and laborers, and there's multiple programs on every that service every job site.
Right, but right now, on a job site, a carpenter, you're saying that they may be reporting who's in charge of the carpenters under the apprenticeship program. So when the apprentices are, if this were to go through and you would be out in the field, the carpenters would then, all the trades would then report to the general contractor?
Yeah, the general contractor manages the project, unless it's a CMGC type of
thing. So sometimes, right now as it stands, sometimes apprentices report to the general contractor and sometimes they report to the subcontractor, or right now they support to the subcontractor?
Could maybe ahead, I'll
yes, please clarify.
I'll share some real time examples.
I want to understand how the law works, how the programs work, rather than what the options are.
Right. So I'll just explain. So as a contractor signatory to the carpenters, anybody we employ doing carpentry work under our T-girding construction side will be a union carpenter. So. And let's say right now we have 40 carpenters working from Southern Oregon up to Portland and Central Coast and all over. We will, when we need additional workers, we will call the local union hall, and we will say we need a carpenter. If we're crewed such that we would like apprentices, we will ask for apprentices as well, mm-hmm. and then they will get dispatched out to us . If they're a core employee that continues to work with us from one project and then we ask them to come to another project and then to another project, they track through their apprenticeship and they will get a notice from the union and they will take a week off and go up to Portland for training.
So they're reporting to the general contractor.
They're reporting to the general contractor. And we report hours. Okay. To the union.
So through the apprenticeship program, I understand that you have different functions, and you did a good job of explaining the different duties they may be doing. But with those, they're always reporting to the general contractor. The general contractor is supervising them during their apprenticeship time
there's,
as an apprentice.
There's a joint relationship between the contractor
and the
union.
And the union, but not with this. But the subcontractor is not in charge of the apprentices now.
So each contractor is required to be a registered training agent with the state of Oregon in order to employ apprentices. Mm-hmm. So they are the direct supervision for these apprentices. Mm-hmm. Now, in the case of this bill, the general contractor is the guy that's going to be overseeing all those subcontractors. There's no requirement in this bill to be that a subcontractor have 10%, but there's an overall requirement for a 10% utilization. Mm-hmm. Some will say that that's a flaw in the bill, and actually what that does is it creates some flexibility for small contractors. Sometimes you will have a small curb and sidewalk contractor that is a small contractor, may have 3 or 4 people. One's a laborer, one's a cement finisher, one's a carpenter, and there's not enough room for apprentices to have adequate supervision. So smaller contractors really struggle sometimes with these bills or these requirements, and this would create a little bit of flexibility there. And the general contractor, at the end of the day, will monitor those apprenticeship hours over all the subcontractors mm-hmm. and his own workforce on the job site.
But could there be a scenario where there's a subcontractor that is very familiar with, you know, they're in charge of the plumbing. I'll just make up an example. So they're in charge of the plumbing. So if this bill were to go through, then the plumbing apprentices, they would need to be supervised by the general contractor when it may make more sense for them to be supervised by the subcontractor.
Well, in order to be on the job site working as an apprentice, you have to be under the supervision of a journeyman of the same trade.
Okay.
So that mm-hmm. apprentice wouldn't be sent to the general contractor. They'd be dispatched to the subcontractor, in this case a plumbing subcontractor, mm-hmm. and that plumbing subcontractor would have been registered as a training agent and responsible for the day-to-day work that apprentice has done. In the field, these young people highly supervised. Their work, the contractor that they're dispatched to agrees to take an active role in their training. Only part of their training takes place in the classroom, some technical work. Mm-hmm. The rest of it is supervised on the job site, and the contractor promises to take an active role in making sure that those individuals aren't, as an example, sweeping all the time, that they're actually engaged in the work and different work processes. That creates a well-rounded journey person, and that moves the industry forward. And each of those subcontractors will still be responsible for their direct workforce. It's just the overall hours of the project that the general would be responsible for under this bill.
Okay. Well, maybe we should have the next panel come up, and unless anyone has any questions. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So why don't we have Ryan Tribbett, Tim Frew, and John Jensen come up. And then, Brian, there's only really room for three, so we'll have you come up later. You can squeeze in next to them if you want to be up there at the same time.
Okay,
who wants to start?
Okay, I'll start. Ryan Tribbett here today on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors Association, also the Iron Workers Local 29. So one of the past panelists described, you know, set out the sort of background as they saw it, which I think I'm going to do too, because that sort of the details you remember are subjective. But when the previous bill was introduced in the 2013 session, and we originally ran it past our leadership, then president of the building trades and business manager Kevin Jensen identified the issues with it, that it's not as simple as it sounds. Of just we utilize 10%. It's who is actually responsible and dictates where that 10% is coming from. And the way that this bill is structured is the same as the bill from 2013, where you have the general contractor reporting to or issuing directives to the subcontractors that they desire. You will provide X amount of apprentices on this job. Yes, it provides flexibility, they say, but it's the flexibility for the general contractor. That becomes problematic because it's each contractor and subcontractor who joins their own separate JATCs. They're the ones who know the curriculum standards. They're the ones who know their individual apprentices, and they're the ones who know what type of experience each apprentice needs to continue advancing through their program. Just because something is a public project doesn't mean that it's necessarily the type of work experience that a particular apprentice is deficient and needing to advance through their program to graduation. And that is what we should be focused on. If we're going to do something real for apprentices, it should be focused on the apprentice, not just on whether we hit some arbitrary 10% number. We believe in the utilization requirement as well. We just have a different way of going about doing it. And I don't think of it in terms of it being all of these bells and whistles. In fact, I think it provides the same type of flexibility they are talking about in their testimony, but I think it does it in a more elegant way. So we believe that each contractor should be responsible for dispatching their apprentices that they employ. Nobody else should be dispatching someone else's apprentices on the job and saying where they should be working. And we think that the contractors who work on public projects should be doing that. Through the responsible bidder approach, you know, the responsible bidder is a form that every contractor fills out now if they bid on public projects. It's where they show that they're licensed and bonded, and they vouch that they have general liability insurance and workers' compensation coverage and all of those things. All we're suggesting, and it's on page 8 of the A5 amendment if you want to look at it, is there's literally a box that they check that says that I belong to a BOLI-approved JATC. So we don't believe this is an overly complicated hurdles or hoops to jump through for it. And if you talk to BOLI, they'll tell you for a contractor to join a JATC, all they have to call and request to be added and to join the JATC. It is upon utilizing apprentices that then there is a cost for paying for like training that goes into it. But just to check the box, it doesn't cost anything to a contractor. And the 10% that's required comes from the JATC level, the Joint Apprenticeship and Training Committee. So you have large contractors and small contractors that all belong to the same JATCs within specific crafts. The JATC can get their numbers from the large contractors and let the small contractors off the hook from having to do it so that it doesn't create an unreasonable burden for small and emerging businesses. It also then is not, it doesn't just focus on a portion of the portfolio. It allows contractors to count any of the hours that they utilize apprentices in their entire book of work. So they could count the hours that apprentices use in their private works or in their public works. That, we believe, provides additional flexibility for the contractors to meet the standard. And so we believe that the A5 amendment is the far superior policy, not because it's extreme or weak or anything. If we're going to go forward with a policy, it should be a real one, and it should be a real policy focused on what is the best for the apprentice. And having someone who is not under the existing bill, having someone who is not educated on what the subcontractor programs are, does not know those apprentices, does not know what they need to advance through their programs, should not be the one dictating whether or they work on one project or another project.
Okay. Well, I want to make certain we get to hear from everybody today. We understand that this is, people are very interested in this bill, committee members, so we need to really pay attention to all these details here. So, Mr. Furu.
Good afternoon, Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Canope, members of the committee. My name is Tim Furu, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. With approximately 25,000 workers in 21 unions and 6 regional councils in Oregon, and we do construction in literally every corner of the state. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about the Dash A5 amendment to House Bill 2162A. Though I understand the basic premise of apprentice utilization, I believe HB 2162A fails to address the importance of who directs the apprentice. As an IBEW journeyman wireman who instructed and supervised apprentices, and as a former trustee to the Joint Apprenticeship Training Committee, I believe the apprentice is better served when directed by the subcontractor as opposed to the general contractor. Please refer to the submitted Electrician Apprentice Monthly Progress Report. On the left side of the report, you can see the list work processes as per standards. The list is broken up by residential, commercial, industrial, and specialized systems, with each category's scope of work defined with a minimum hours required. 8,000 on-the-job hours are required before an apprentice is eligible to sit for their Oregon General Journeyman License exam. By the subcontractor directing and supervising the work assignments, as opposed to the general contractor, ensures that the apprentice will get the necessary on-the-job hours needed for the apprentice to sit for their exam. I believe the Oregon Building Trades Council's amendments to the Dash A5 amendments to House Bill 2162A provides a simple solution to a better apprenticeship utilization bill. I'd also like to add, we're not that far apart. Really, we're not. I mean, we're very proud. We're all very proud of our apprenticeship programs. We're all very much aware of the importance of CTE and how that's a conduit to enter into our apprenticeship programs. And Senator Hansel, to your point about the House bill, I'm not minimizing the fact that the House bill, it passed overwhelmingly on the House floor. But I'd also like to bring it to your attention that I think there's a little bit of a flawed process. And a part of that flawed process was the fact that when we submitted our original Dash 1 amendments, it didn't make it to OLIS. It was sat on for 22 days. So then when we wanted to submit it before the work session, it got submitted to OLIS, it wasn't submitted until 48 hours before the work session. So therefore, I say it was a flawed process, and I believe that The committee members of Business and Labor of that committee did not have ample amount of time to look at our Dash 1 amendment. Okay. And as a result, I think on the day of the work session, you can parse it however way you want, is to say that it came out unanimously. Well, technically, no, because Representative Hurd was absent excused. I just wanted to bring that to light because I think that as a result, that's why if you say that it almost seems like we didn't really push it on the House side, at that point, we were pretty frustrated, and we said, you know what? And knowing the history of this, that it probably wasn't pursued as much as it should have been on the Senate side back in 2013.
So, Mr. Fur, you had said that, you know, you're not that far off from the folks who are less than happy, or the folks who are bringing this forward, the base bill here from the House. What would need to be changed in order, in your opinion, in order for, if you were king and could make everyone happy, what would you do?
Well, I think that, you know, there's a lot of reference to the contractor, and that's very general to me. That's extremely general. So in place of contractor, if you were to put subcontractor, contractor slash subcontractor, but if you had a reference to subcontractor, I think that what it does is it puts the onus on the subcontractor for the 10% utilization. So that means that In some respects, it takes it off the general contractor. Yes, the general contractor, he oversees the project, and he has to make sure that, you know, that apprentice utilization is being met throughout the whole project. But I think that if you put it on the onus of the subcontractor is going to make sure that they're fulfilling that obligation. But more importantly, they're going to make sure that that apprentice is getting the training that they deserve and that they need.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Mr. Jensen.
Thank you, Chair Taylor, members of the committee. My name is John Jensen. I represent IBEW Local 48. We have thousands of electrical workers in both Northwest Oregon and Southwest Washington. So there's been a lot discussed here. The only thing I'd really add is when I reached out to my Washington people who have a model similar to this, one of the problems they identified with that model is where it's directed by the general contractor, they have seen where instead of it encouraging apprenticeship, a general contractor just targeted one specific craft like us, who has a very rusto-but apprenticeship program, and expected them to carry the burden for the entire job. So that's one of the redresses they're seeking up in Washington, is a cap so that no subcontractor is required to have more than X percent be apprentices, right? So that's one of the fine reasons, and as part of the work group, that we believe that if you really want to incentivize and encourage apprenticeship, to do it in a way that targets the subcontractor, who is their training agent, right, who understands the work and the apprentices. So, you know, both for our contractors, but also just for apprenticeship, if you want to support it, the best way to do that is through the subcontractor.
Okay, and so on the House side, now we have the Dash 5. Just so I understand, this was the Dash what on the House side?
I can take this. It was the Dash 1 amendment.
And then
the
you came up 48 hours ahead of time, and then was that heard?
No.
Okay, and so you did not testify on that. Did you testify on the base bill?
Correct. And we told them that we were working on an amendment that was the product of a year and a half long working group, and that we were looking forward to an opportunity to discuss all the considerations that the working group had made and why they had chosen and selected a direction. While it wasn't a consensus, it was certainly a majority opinion of the members of the working group to pursue the policy that was contained in Senate Bill 809 last session, which is also the Dash 1 amendment, which is also the A5 amendment.
Okay, so this work group that met for over a year, I'm going to have the other folks who are supporting the bill come up back up after you so we hear both sides of this so we can get to the bottom of all this out in the daylight here. Mr. Fru, maybe you could answer this. You were at the work group meetings, or were you not, or only Mr. Trivett was, or were you there too during the work group, during the meetings?
No, that was before my time.
Okay, and so were you just, Mr. Sorrent? Okay, yeah. So why don't you tell us what your understanding is, however comfortable you feel saying it. If you don't feel comfortable, that's fine. I just want to, at the end of this work group, did you feel that an agreement had been made? Or do you feel like you were just working toward it, but an agreement had not been made?
Madam Chair, I don't know how to say it differently than it was not a consensus. There was not unanimous support around pursuing any of them. I actually submitted to the exhibits people the report that Senator Dembro filed at the end of that process.
Okay.
And he went through the five different policy options that were considered.
Yeah.
Both the version that's in the underlying bill and the responsible bidder version were two of those considerations. And it actually talks about why the conclusion was there. But I can tell you there were more people supporting the responsible bidder version than who opposed it. And I will admit the local governments were not participating on the working group at that time. Only people with expertise in apprenticeship were.
And so are you mainly concerned about, because obviously the building trades covers so many of the different trades, is your concern more about just all the trades in general, or is there some way that the carpenters, would it ever make sense for the carpenters to report differently than the rest of the other apprentices, or does that not make sense?
We, Madam Chair, the general rule has been, from my opinion, that we try to stay out of each other's areas. We don't have usually opinions about how someone wants to govern their own process. Part of our frustration's been that such a niche craft has been suggesting a policy that would affect the entire rest of the 21 crafts and 30,000 workers. So that's been a frustration.
All right. Does anybody have any other questions? Okay. Thank you. I'm going to, Brian, why don't you hold on 1 second? I don't know if Ron, Jack, or Tom, or all of you can come up. It doesn't matter to me. Whoever wants to come up, I just want to get a sense of whoever wants to speak to who, of the three of you, who attended this year plus. You were the person that went to the meetings?
I was on the committee, yes.
You're on the committee. Okay, so.
And Tom was on the committee as well.
And you were there. You were both at the meetings? Both of you were there throughout the whole process? Okay. I'm just trying to get an understanding because I hear about this work group, and I also heard about this from the House side.
So
what was your understanding of, was there an agreement in your mind or not an agreement, or what were you thinking at the end of the work group?
No agreement came out of the committee.
Okay.
The bill that he's referring to, the responsible bidder approach. The issue with that is, and the reason I think why the contractors couldn't support it, was it required, he referred to the standard, that you would have to maintain your standards. Well, it wouldn't just be on public contracting. It would require you to have a 10 or 20% utilization even on private work. So then it would put the state in the position of imposing a regulation on non-public works. It would require that you utilize 10 or 20% on everything you did year-round, and if you did that in 1 year, then you would qualify to bid on public works. Well, obviously, that's very difficult. And imagine for a small contractor who on some projects, each of our standards, I mean, there's a whole learning curve to this apprenticeship program thing, but each of our standards that are held by the state tell us how many apprentices we can have for how many journeymen are on the job site. Now, it's being made out that the general contractor is responsible for that, but you can't get an apprentice working under you as a subcontractor unless you're a registered training agent. And at that point, you are responsible for that individual.
Okay.
Also, you can't carry the burden for the job either because your state standards does have a limit on it.
Okay.
Mine is 20%. I can't have more than 20% apprentices on the job site.
So your understanding when either of you, when the work group came, you had your last meeting, what did you feel, what did you think was the understanding when you left?
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, so...
And sometimes people don't come to consensus. I mean, we have work groups where that happens. It's not as if this never happened before. I'm just trying to understand both sides of what happened.
Yes. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that was very much the outcome. There was no agreement.
Okay.
And so we met in excess of a year as an apprenticeship task force. And yeah, there was no consensus. And I guess a little bit of history. This very bill, the strip down that with no amendments, is very, very similar to a bill that passed unanimously through the Senate in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Then in 2015, basically what the amendment would do to this bill now was defeated. And so it goes back to the give and pay. I guess one piece I'd like to put forth is I'm both a general contractor and I also have another entity that is a specialty subcontractor. So I live both sides of this. The general contractor never manages subcontractors' apprentices. Only if the general contractor is self-performing work, then those apprentices are their own employees. So the last group testifying, it sounded much more complex than what it is. The subcontractors manage their apprentices. The general contractor manages the project, does the reporting for the apprentices. And I think one piece that's very important is if you apply a 10% rule, let's just say across the board, all subcontractors, that's what we would call trade specific. And there is a huge number of subcontractors that are very small business, maybe 3-4 employees. They now have either 25-33% apprenticeship or zero apprenticeship. And so when you get trade specific, it becomes very complicated in trying to impose that given piece.
Okay.
Chair Taylor, Jack Dempsey again. Just to clarify, regardless of whether that concept or how that proposal that's in the amendment came out of that committee, that was the concept that the Senate did not push forward last session.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason why we didn't bring it back this session and started with a more bare bones approach.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line on that.
I was just trying to thank you. I appreciate that. I just was trying to understand because since there was this long work group instead of meetings, I wanted to understand what the outcome of that was. Thank you, gentlemen. Brian Krieg, did you want to come up still? Okay.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Krieg, and today I'm here representing the sheet metal and air conditioning contractors and their labor partner, Sheet Metal Workers Local 16, the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, and their labor partner, UA 290, and then also the State Association of Electrical Workers, which is many of the IBEW units throughout the state, other than 48, but 48 is part of that group. I'll try to keep this brief, and I'm going to reiterate the issue about the subcontractors and their labor organizations working together to put together and manage and fund their apprenticeship programs. The crafts that I represent, electrical, plumbing, HVAC, sheet metal, are all programs that are 4 to 5 years long. This is a very significant difference from some of the other crafts. Some of them have much shorter time periods on it. Some of them have much shorter expenses for their training and their training centers. This is something that, in case of our crafts, we fund through the funds that we raise through cents per hour on that. It's not something that the state pays for. The problem isn't simple on here, but it really does boil down to one key issue, and that is that it is not craft specific for doing this project. That 10% could land on as few as one craft and subcontractor on a job. And depending on the size of the job, and these are larger jobs, that could be a significant problem to try to actually gin up the manpower for that time period. We may and very likely have that many apprentices and many more in the entire system that we would have through our union, but for one kind of pig going through the python for a moment, we may not be able to get to that number on there. But overall, this is where we were going back in the other language for like Senate Bill 809 last time. We were trying to look at it as more of what are we doing with the pool, and are we advancing the pool in our craft? Are all the crafts advancing the pool there so that it isn't just landing on one specifically on there? It's a big challenge for our contractors to try to determine what the workforce need is there, because we want those apprentices to be able to work throughout that 4 to 5 year time period. We don't want them to end up sitting in the hall because we can lose them, and that's a big investment for us. It's a terrible shame for them. And if you look back over the last 17 years, we've had a couple of very big down cycles for construction. So this is very difficult to try to put together for a contractor to figure out what their workforce is, and then also for the apprenticeship programs. So I think I will conclude with that.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you so much. All right, so more thinking. Everyone on the committee needs to contemplate their thoughts on the three bills from today. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2162A. The next meeting is going to be on Wednesday. Why does it say?
Sorry, Wednesday.
That's okay. It's okay, Wednesday, May 17th. And you can look for the agenda. I think that we already have that drafted, though.
Mm-hmm.
So for Monday, folks, we are going to have work sessions on House Bill 3008A, and then we'll have public hearings and possible work sessions on 2567 and 3060A. I don't have a work session scheduled for House Bill 2162A that we just heard. I think maybe there needs to be some additional conversations around that particular bill at this
Madam
point.
Chair, it will need to be posted by Friday, though. If
I know, I understand yeah. that, yeah. But thank you for reminding me. I always like reminders. I always like reminders. I like it when my colleagues look out for me. So I'm going to go ahead and adjourn the meeting.
Just a quick question.
Oh, yes, Senator.
It looked like 2567A, there might be some ability to do some amendments to that. It sounded, if I...
But this is Representative Witt's bill?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you wanted to, is there an amendment on OLIS?
I don't know what there is, well, but I heard Betsy say
Betsy
that there were several.
Several
oh, yes. And oh, yeah. No, thank you for bringing that to my attention.
And the representative was not, yeah, we could do that. And
I think that we should circle back. Thank you for bringing that up. I think that we'll have to hear from them. We have it down as a possible work session,
okay.
Not as guaranteed. So it's a public hearing again. So if they do come forward with an amendment, we could hear the amendment. And maybe they'll work something out between now and then. So that was one of the reasons why I put it up as a possible work session. And we can always carry it over to the following Monday if needed. So any other questions? Okay, we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting. We'll see everybody on Wednesday. Everybody on Wednesday. The meeting will...